What happens when a natural disaster strikes and suddenly flashlights cost twice as much? Is this price gouging immoral or serving a hidden purpose? These questions form the heart of The Price of Everything, where we meet Ramon Fernandez, a Cuban-American tennis star at Stanford, and economics professor Ruth Lieber. Through their conversations following a Bay Area earthquake, we discover how prices orchestrate our complex world without a conductor. When Ramon witnesses a big box store doubling prices after the disaster, his sense of justice is offended. The scene of a young mother unable to afford diapers triggers memories of his own mother's struggles after fleeing Cuba. Yet this moral outrage becomes the catalyst for a deeper exploration of how markets function beyond our immediate perceptions. The earthquake plunges the Bay Area into darkness, and Ramon finds himself at a big box store with doubled prices. Water bottles, normally $4.99, now cost $9.98. Flashlights that were $12.99 are marked $25.98. Outside, angry customers protest what they see as exploitation. Inside, Ramon notices Maria, a Spanish-speaking mother, counting insufficient dollars for diapers and formula while her infant cries. Using his status as a Stanford athlete, he collects donations from other customers, then grabs an abandoned megaphone and shares his family's immigration story, organizing the crowd to document the price increases and file complaints. But later, Professor Ruth challenges his assumptions. When prices rise after a disaster, she explains, they're actually sending crucial signals. Higher prices discourage hoarding and ensure resources reach those who need them most. She describes how price controls during the 1970s energy crisis created gas shortages, with people sleeping in cars overnight waiting for fuel. This tension between our moral intuition that raising prices during emergencies feels wrong and the economic reality that price signals help allocate scarce resources efficiently reveals how markets often work in counterintuitive ways. Look at those birds, Ruth says, pointing to swallows darting above a marsh. No single bird directs their movement, yet they create beautiful formations. When a hawk appears, hundreds of birds instantly coordinate without a leader. Markets work the same way. No central planner tells everyone what to produce, yet millions coordinate through price signals. Ruth challenges Ramon's assumption that coordination requires central control. Prices communicate essential information about scarcity and value between strangers. When coffee crops fail in Brazil, rising prices tell people in Seattle to conserve without knowing why. This decentralized coordination explains why market economies outperform centrally planned ones. Soviet planners couldn't match the essential information that emerges through millions of voluntary exchanges. The beauty of markets, Ruth concludes, is that they harness the dispersed knowledge of millions, creating order from chaos. Like a watch's mechanisms, prices constantly adjust to coordinate billions of actions. Ramon's father, Jose Fernandez, Cuba's greatest baseball player, refused to defect despite lucrative offers. After Jose's death, Ramon's mother, Celia, fled Castro's regime with her son by boat to Florida. In Miami, Celia built their new life, working while learning English to support Ramon's education. She preserved their heritage through stories of his father. Ramon's athletic journey began with baseball at 5, then shifted to tennis at 8. His talent flourished. He won Junior Wimbledon and later became NCAA singles champion as a Stanford freshman. This background shaped Ramon's economic perspectives, particularly his wariness of corporate power and concern for justice. His experience of Cuba's central planning failures informed his views on markets and freedom. As Ruth notes, your experiences shape how you see economic systems, revealing how lived experience colors theoretical understanding. How long would it take a maid in 1900 to earn enough for a dozen eggs? Ruth asks Ramon. About 3 hours. Today, just 6 minutes. This 30-fold improvement in purchasing power demonstrates markets' impact on living standards. Modern egg farms showcase this efficiency. two workers can oversee 800,000 chickens producing 240 million eggs annually, compared to traditional farming requiring 3 million free-range chickens and extensive labor. Ruth explains that competition, not corporate generosity, drives savings to consumers through lower prices. Early innovators benefit briefly until market forces reduce costs. In Ruth's office, Ramon notices tombstones, lucite blocks containing IPO announcements from Kenny's venture capital wins. She shares Tom Worson's story of developing revolutionary internet hardware from garage to manufacturing facility over 7 years. His only regret, his estranged father never saw his success. She recalls David Kornfeld, whose medical laser innovation transformed retinal surgery. Despite a $440 million company sale, his greatest satisfaction came from patients thanking him for saving their sight. People are driven by both money and passion, Ruth explains. The beauty is how these motivations combine to create both wealth and human joy. Ruth uses pollution as an example of market imperfections. When you drive, you don't pay for the toxins from your tailpipe that others breathe. While government can regulate such externalities, politicians often prioritize special interests over public good, and ineffective government programs tend to persist, unlike failed products. Addressing Ramon's concerns about chicken farming ethics, Ruth acknowledges the issues while noting consumer choice in free-range options. She challenges romanticized views of traditional farming, citing heritage chickens' lower productivity and higher risks. On job displacement, she explains how labor markets evolve. While transitions affect workers, increased productivity creates opportunities, evidenced by America's growth from 30 million jobs in 1900 to over 130 million a century later. Ruth attributes national prosperity to physical and human capital, dispersed power, risk-taking policies, open trade, rule of law, and trust. Above all, prosperity requires freedom to innovate, compete, take risks, and fail. She acknowledges that some goods, like national defense, need collective provision, and markets require legal frameworks. The market is a tool, not a religion, she concludes, emphasizing the importance of understanding when to rely on markets versus other approaches.
20 years after their Stanford conversations, Ramon, now a potential successor to lead post-Castro Cuba, visits Ruth to discuss how she recognized his leadership potential. Ruth explains that early American presidents were typically founding fathers, their relatives, or military heroes. Voters trust familiar figures. Ramon's athletic fame had made him Cuba's most recognizable figure after Castro, but Ruth had seen his unique blend of intellectual curiosity, charisma, and patriotism. Ruth believes economic literacy provides an essential framework for civic participation and leadership. Her greatest satisfaction came from planting seeds of economic understanding in promising students like Ramon. Driving down Highway 1, Ramon reflects on his journey from refugee to potential reformist leader, carrying Ruth's vital lesson. Effective leaders understand both the limits of centralized control and the power of organic, bottom-up systems, knowledge essential for Cuba's transformation. Remember, when prices speak, wisdom listens. A seemingly unfair price may tell an important story about our world.